Okay, these are the results for hydrogen. So you let the shop ring up to its peak pressure, and you can see we're going up for megabars. The resistivity drops about 4 orders of magnitude, and then it plateaus. You see deuterium and hydrogen, but again, we did those to change the temperatures and densities. There's no isotope effect at 3,000 degrees. The quantum system, 3,000 degrees is not significant for that. Okay, question. What causes this? This took a year of staring at before I had an urban colony, but you know, previous history was about it. So what is this, the value that's expected, and what about the density? Is that expected? So we'll talk about that in a minute. Then what's the nature of observing? And also, is there anything else on Earth that's ever been observed to do something similar? And the answer is yes. It's Peter Schenzel at Marburg did these very nice experiments on alkaline metals many years ago, where he put them in a chamber, God knows what it was made of, because you're talking about fully alkalized at 2,000 degrees Kelvin, it's completely corrosive. And he heated it to 2,000 degrees, and it disordered enough, melted and so forth, that it went, the alkalized with the semiconductors. He only needed 100 bars, and he squeezed the system back together, measuring the conductivity as he went. And he got this plateau value. And if you look at our data, it's the same thing. In other words, we had the same values of conductivity, and we reached basically the same plateau value. And this value here is called the minimum conductivity of the metal. It's the point at which the mean free path for conduction is the distance between adjacent particles supplying the electron. Called the Alpha-Rigel limit. It's something that came out of semiconductor physics 30 years ago. And once you realize that, you know, immediately to suggest other diatomics. It says that if that's the simple idea, then it can't matter what the diatomic is. So think about that in a minute. But just this particular state here, you have the charge densities on two adjacent hydrogens, and you say this is the size, say the 4 radius, and this is the distance between two of them. Then when the ratio of A star to this is about 0.25 to 0.3, you should have metal, because at that point an electron can be localized to one to the next. This is Mott's criteria. This is what I call Mott scale density. So if you treat these as hydrogen is diatomic and the alkalized is monatomic, then you have these values here. If you make it atomic hydrogen, then this moves out, this moves in a little. The 4 radius of the molecule is the same as the atom. So you just change the density by a factor of 2, but it's 2 to the cubed root, so things don't change very much. What it says is you just got to push them together enough to let an electron hop.
Bill?
Yeah.
It seems to me that you must have some faith to see a plateau in the alkaline metal curve.
It depends how you plot it. If you plot it in density,
okay,
it's very narrow. If you plot it in pressure, it's not.
Okay. It's well defined in the data.
Yeah, it's well defined in the data.
Bill?
Yeah.
Am I correct in saying that the resistivity of a fully ionized plasma would be about 2 orders of magnitude smaller than your plateau, something like 10 to minus 5?
We'll get to that, I'm sure. That's what you guys have calculated.
Sorry?
Yeah. That's what you have calculated, but I don't think you can get there from here. Okay. At least not without some really big changes. I don't think we'll ever see that. We'll talk about it in a minute. The point is, this is a standard condensed matter idea of minimum metallic conductivity. And the conductivity is determined by a mean free path. This value is not sensitive on anything, density, temperature, element, basically. So to try to get 3 orders of magnitude higher, you need to have a much longer mean free path.
That plot, Bill, that I think assumes,
atomic
hydrogen, right?
Yeah, this one assumes atomic hydrogen.
Okay.
If you assume diatomic, then the hydrogen moves in a little.
Yeah.
I guess the point we're making here is that this curve is not very sensitive to composition of Turkish species. It's just saying that they're close enough together to hop, and what's actually in there, you can't tell from this point. Okay, now we fit this data to a density-dependent mobility gap. In other words, it's a disordered system. There have to be states at the Fermi level, but they're not conducting because it looks exponential. So the standard way is to disordered semiconductor, people get around it, to treat it as if it has a gap, and the states around it are localized. When we did that, I have everything in RS, so Neil asked me what's RS. It's under your grant. Okay, this is the density dependence of the gap from the previous data. We have to calculate density and temperature. We're in a new regime that would be of interest to everybody here at Miles Planets in terms of density and pressure. But we don't know how to measure density yet. We know how to measure pressure, but not density and temperature. So we have to calculate this with a couple of models. And you have to calculate density and temperature to fit the data. So this is the temperatures we got out of our calculation of our simulations of our impact experiments. This is the result from the fit. This is the gap I showed you for single-shot hydrogen a minute ago. This line points at this. So we just draw a dashed line in here. This is Marvin's. He had a model for dissociation of lower pressures, and I just looked at the paper he wrote and scrambled into it as to what it would be at these densities. And what this suggests is that metallization occurs by thermal smearing of the mobility gap. Most of the energy goes into electronic excitation, but there is some dissociation that goes on in this system. And that the gap in this booklet is basically linear. I mean, it could be weird things, but for all intents and purposes, based on what we know, it's linear. Okay, so for theoreticians, it's RS. This thing is happening about 1.6.
Is there a way of doing a set of experiments still with pure hydrogen where you get to different temperatures at a given pressure? Obviously, you could imagine doing this starting with different initial conditions.
Yeah.
But that's of interest, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because sure. That will shed light on the mechanism.
Right.
You want to be able to get to other parts of the diagram in PT space.
Sure. Sure. The answer is yes. And you do it the way you're saying. You change. There's no time to turn on a heater or let cooling occur. It's a 100 nanosecond experiment. Mm-hmm. So you're just right there. When you make the anvil stiffer, like increase the density factor of 2, which is possible. I didn't believe this. We started looking at crystalline materials. We use 4 gram per cubic centimeter sapphire. But there are crystals available that are 9. And there are things like lithium chloride that go down at 2.7. So you can change the temperature by the Shock-Stevens mismatch between the anvil and the liquid. You can also change the initial density of the hydrogen itself, and that's what your piece is working on, is a continuously controllable. You can control the temperature continuously. You can change the temperature of the starting state, you change the density. So yeah, that's you want to do that. Okay, what's the nature of the fluid? I mean, first of all, is it a metal? The minimum conductivity of metal assumes it's degenerate, right? So how degenerate is it? Well, if you take all the electrons of what I'm defining to be the metallization density, that is where the gap is kT, and use a free electron Fermi energy, which is typically used for liquid metal, you get a Fermi energy of about 20 volts. I calculated temperatures about 10 volts, so we're like 1/100 of the Fermi temperature, highly degenerate system.
That assumes that all the electrons are free, right?
Yeah.
Only 5% of the electrons are ionized.
No, you have to put all the electrons that could conduct into the Fermi.
I think this is a nomenclatural issue. What you should be saying is chemical potential.
All right.
And then that's from the bottom of the band to suddenly the gap.
But there are 2 electrons per molecule in the band, is what I'm saying.
But it could initially be a non-degenerate semi-metal, right?
Yeah. Well,
you have to be careful again. I mean, the band is a wide band system.
It's getting small.
There's a lot of energy in the motion of the electron. It's just that they're not conducting like classical semiconductors.
Yeah, but
silicon has a very wide band.
Yeah.
But for the same chemical potential, it could be a partially degenerate electron gas. That's the difference. I mean, I don't fully agree with the last part of stuff, but anyway.
I didn't expect it. All I'm saying is, if you go through this analysis, you assume what the mechanism is, you go through and calculate who this treatment is consistent. And we need to change the temperatures, as Dave says, to be sure the mechanism is correct. However, I'll show you in a minute, the oxygen and nitrogen do the same thing based on the same thing. I don't believe it's a degenerate, a non-degenerate semiconductor. The KT is the gap, so there is no gap. I don't know how to probe. If you have some ideas about how to probe that idea in these experiments, I'd appreciate it. Okay, so it's degenerate electronically. What about the vibrational motion of energy levels of the molecule? Well, the free hydrogen molecule has a ground state of 3,000 Kelvin, which is the temperatures for that. First excited state is about 9,000. So we're in a regime of temperature where quantum effects have to be considered for the vibrational states of the molecule. So I don't know how to do that. I'm not sure anybody does. But nevertheless, this implies the quantum nature of these vibrations is important. Marvin estimated 10%, assuming atoms or molecules, and I think that's a question. And I don't think that's what they are. I'll show you some results in a minute. Anyway, at these low temperatures, this is what I call this temperature modest, but it's quantum fluid.
Well, I think you give two sort of not really compatible pictures. You say it's a highly degenerate electron gas, and then below you put it the same transparency. Well, it's molecular. There's two things. If you, the density is high enough, the electron gas becomes degenerate and you can't have molecular binding.
Well, I don't see the contradiction in that.
The electrons are degenerated, delocalized, and they cannot bind them.
The density of
there's still correlations in the okay. Sure, the notion of a specific vibrational state is really fuzzy here. I'll put it that way. All I'm saying is that the fact that there can be quantum, that the interactions are quantum in nature, needs to be considered. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, the Booker is right. If 90% based on Mervyn's model of the stuff you see on a molecular form, H2 plus, say, the density of free electrons is going to be very small, much smaller than you assume in the first part.
Well, that's the assumption. I don't think it's true based on these quantum simulations.
It cannot be both.
Look, I think the point is, which physical property are you interested in? If your interest is in the energy, where you have an electron spectrum which is extremely wide, and there's a huge amount of what we would call degenerate kinetic energy in the electron system there. If your interest is in those carriers at the top of the bands that are participating in conduction, then it's a totally different issue.
Can I tell them what I think?
Sure.
My feeling is that at high densities, if you have 5 to 10% of the molecules, electrons excited, but you have 5 to 10% of the molecules that are associated with the atoms, and you calculate the Fermi energy of those 5 to 10%. At these densities, you have a Fermi energy of like 3 to 5 volts. And that's typical of alkaline metals. So you're getting an alkaline metal conductivity, which is consistent with the experiments. It just takes 5 to 10% dissociated, which gives you about 20% atoms. And that's enough. And because of the densities are so high, from free electrons, you get a Fermi energy, like I say, of 3 to 5 volts, like an alkaline metal.
Yeah.
And you get conductivity that's like an alkaline metal.
But it's not quite the same thing as saying that T over TF equals 10 to the minus.
Yeah, right. I didn't say it's less than 1.
You didn't say that.
That issue, the fact is 0.01. Well, that's a.
All right,
I think I'm working for
there's about 20 minutes to Bill's talk, and Marvin has a talk on Friday.
We'll be able to interject in this too.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, about 20 minutes.
Now. How does this agree with simple theory? Theory for me has got to be simple, or I can't even. Okay, I'm calling this the density. I don't speak equation. I mean, at this density, would you expect hydrogen to be metallic in a disordered fluid? It's not metallic in the solid. It's true. But the reason it's metallic here is it's disordered. And is that a reasonable density?
Why is disordered? It's not hot.
It's disordered because it's supposed to be melted.
No, he's asking, why is it that you are claiming that it's a metal because it's disordered?
Oh, it's highly degenerate.
As opposed to hot.
It's highly degenerate. No, the temperature is simply there to melt the system. It's not there to excite it.
I think there's a claim of circularity, if I understand correctly.
If I can make a little...
I think the bottom line is already it's a complex liquid.
Yes, it's a very complex liquid.
If I just, can I just make a little comment?
You're going to cut me off.
The point I want to make is that I fully agree with Martin that you get the connectivity, which is something like a metal connectivity. And that's point one. I fully agree with that. But saying that T over T equals 10 to the minus 2 means that most of your stuff is under a fully ionized quantum degenerate system, which is a structural point of view, which is completely different.
Okay, so I'll just tell you a little bit about quantum simulations. They did these really nice movies at Los Alamos. And what you see is that you have in the liquid, and Julie, I have some stuff that Julie got. You have these things vibrating. Now, when they're in the solid, they're vibrating around the lattice point. And they're molecules. They live forever. Then you melt it, whatever melting means in the system. And suddenly, they're free to move about. And they move about because the temperature is 2,000 degrees. And they collide, and they break up. And then they recombine, and so forth. So there's no such thing as a molecule. There's a dimer. Okay, now when that happens, an electron, which was binding two things initially, while an electron popped, when that dimer breaks up, nothing that says that electron can't now, that was moving, that was conducting, can't now go into binding two protons. Well, a different electron. You see what I'm saying? All these electrons are swapping around in the system as well. They have to be swapping around as well as the protons. So I'm just considering all the electrons as part of the conduction seed.
Okay.
That's all.
Is that the time part of the work of Los Alamos?
Yeah.
But then they explain us. This is a very slow process that these molecules exist. And electric doesn't give clocks. So you're explaining that the electron is like a top right and the protons rearranging?
No. The conduction is by electrons.
But they can only go to the...
It can only go to the next particle.
But if they have to rearrange, this takes a long time.
Not after the electron. The time between collisions of the proton of the two molecules is 10 to the minus 14 seconds.
But if you were taking a picture of your stuff, very likely you would get a G of R perturbation function, which is more molecular-like than...
I have one here. If you let me continue, okay. I'll close to you.
That was done at the wrong density, by the way. They did RS of 2.
They showed it in a bunch of RS. I have the movie. Okay. They didn't bring it with me.
When they published it.
No, it's at all the density. All right. Pontus Mesiti was developed 150 years ago. I think he put dielectric constant here, and Hertzberg said, now put an index of refraction. And when you go through a non-metal metal transition, and goes to infinity. So R over V becomes 1. R is the molar refractivity, which is 4/3 pi times the polarizability. You assume it's an atom. And you look up the polarizability of the hydrogen atom in a book. You plug it in this formula, you get this metallization density. This is the one we got from computation and simulating all our experiments. The density we're getting is approximately correct. It's all just the same. Now, since this is a degenerate system, we can argue about the factor, but it's degenerate. It's a metal. This is my formula for the minimum conductivity of metal, which is just the Drude conductivity for a free electron system, one electron per particle for all of it. So we have a density of metallization. You stick that in here, you get 4,000, you measure 2,000. Factor 2 for this transition is perfectly zero. The point I'm trying to make here is the density at which this happens and the value of the measure are correct. Neil calculated what the conductivity would be expected for metallic H2. He got within a factor of 10. It was in the right direction. I mean, design the model is a weak scattering model. This is a very strong scattering system to be the minimum conductivity of the metal. So So one would expect this to be a higher conductivity than what all energy, and the Los Alamos group basically calculated what we got in the metal, not even semiconductor, but in the metal. Again, this is a reasonable number. So what's the picture that comes out of this? First of all, we have a real metal.
This is a whole point of this whole talk. We got one sentence.
Okay, so when it's doing this, you have a very this wide band insulator, and since it's disordered, there are wings on this thing throughout much of this region up here. I want to point out this is like 10% change in density, and this is another 10%. Happen to be right where it's going to metal. We really left out of this experiment. Now, when you push this together with pressure, eventually these wings are going to start to overlap, like so. They have to be stays there because it's a disordered system, but they have to be localized because this is a thermal activation process. Until you apply enough pressure and enough temperature that you squeeze this together and this goes in, and eventually you get a Fermi energy. And this is the minimum conductivity of the metal. That's the idea. And this is the mechanism. It's density driven. It's not temperature driven. It doesn't depend on the degeneration factor. It just has to be degenerative. That's all. It doesn't matter if it's 1 millionth or 1K. Okay. Now, Julia's not here, so I can say what I want. This is Julia Galley at Livermore. She did some computer simulations of this system at similar conditions. They're not quite. I mean, they're higher temperatures. But what she did was she applied a density and temperature similar to what we did. And then she looked at how long did pairs of protons stay within a given distance. That's what's plotted here. How many pairs had stay together when a given distance in terms of vibrational periods of the free molecule, which is 7 femtoseconds. 7 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So 1 means 7 times 10 to the 15 seconds. So what you see is that these dimers don't live very long. Now, this is one vibrational period, this is very short. So it's not molecular, it's not really monatomic, but it's a lot closer to monatomic than molecular. It's an intermediate state.
Is this a density where the gap is close in our calculations?
Yeah, this is for hydrogen atoms, so this would be 0.34. I guess it's 0.33. Yeah, so this would be enough. But the temperature.
I think that's D2, right? Doesn't it say the thermal that we cross?
Yeah,
that's
not our system.
It's double the density.
Right, it's not quite in the calorie.
Yeah, not quite. Yeah,
it's pretty high.
And it's a lot hotter than where we are. All I'm saying here is that these things, this general feature is maintained throughout this regime. The point is the idea that it's a molecule or something else. It's very difficult to define what's the identity. It's the phase identity.
Is there a reason why there isn't something like this of T equals 3,000 uses on?
Yeah. Well, I wish the people who did this were here. But the point is that people, if you're in the regime where it's hot enough that you can treat the protons classically, then they just let them roam around with classical physics, and they just draw a correlation of time between a certain distance. When you get below 5,000 degrees, the calculation starts to be in question because the binding is important.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen anybody actually.
But in a sense, what that means is that this kind of calculation has great difficulty doing precisely the thing that one is most interested in.
Yeah. Exactly. It's in a regime which is not yet there computationally, I think.
But the only reason is that they cannot do quantum protons. That's why they say, well, we go to lower temperature, there's nothing wrong with LDAs. Just that the electrically protons would still be treated classically in that stress.
Yeah. Right. And all I'm saying is the temperature is comparable to the binding energy of free molecules, so that's an assumption, that's all.
Yeah, well, the LDA just, look, it's well known now, LDA gave you metallization at too low a density.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think it's just, I mean, Neil has done a lot of work on that, and that's very well known in static lattice calculations. And it follows to a thermally excited system. It just gives you atomization or metallization at too low a density. And so it really, that's one of the items that really points to the future. Can you do better than LDA in these conditions?
Got under 15 minutes.
Okay, this is the one of the pair correlation functions figured out. You see this little peak here that approximately the inner proton distance for the molecule is a little longer than 0.74 for the free molecule. Since we've had a complex pair distribution function, she's calculating conductivity, you know, within a factor of 5. So it's, you know, for this purpose, that's just an agreement.
What does the 1.82 mean? What is that peak?
Yeah,
look at the curve. I know what the, is that the second?
That's just the position. I don't know what it means. That's the second nearest neighbor, I guess.
Well,
yeah.
Well, maybe it's,
I'm only saying that you should look at, as Neil tells me, you should look at this in terms of the paracorrelation function, not in terms of saying there's
sit on one proton and ask for the probability finding in the next 3 years.
Right.
That's the first one.
Yeah, that's this one.
And then sit on that one proton and look to the next molecule, and shell molecules, that's the second.
This one is
the boundary. We never got anything like that.
That's a shock.
Okay, just a little speculation here. Somebody told me. He was talking about giant planets or brown dwarfs freezing. They'd have to have cooled off quite a bit based on what I heard yesterday.
You mean hydrogen?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, I think he's not here, so. Can't say what you really what's known about hydrogen? I mean, these are three solid phases that have been observed by the diamond cell people from Raman. They're quantum insulators, it's apparent. There could very well be some insulating solid phases. I believe everything in the solid is an insulator. But if you go down here, it's an insulator. And we know that when you melt, you can have semiconducting fluid and metallic fluid, depending on temperature and pressure and so forth. We know we've got one point where you have minimum metallic conductivity. Look at all the theoretical predictions for where it is at zero Kelvin with the Ampere reads out here somewhere. So this slope has to be negative. In other words, metallization is going to require less temperature and higher pressure, which makes sense. You've got to close this gap. And you've got to fill it in, and that's what that says. Eventually, you're going to cross the melt line. This is a very complex melt line. You're going from H2 to H2 dimers. So that is a Margaret melt line, but I think that is going to affect this possibly. When you go here, you've got the thing going from H2 to H2 dimers, whatever it's association recombination, with electronic excitation into the metallic state in a quantum system. It's supposed to be a very complex theory. Anyway, this is for the future. But there's a lot of very interesting physics in this system of binary temperature. Does anything else do this? Well, if it's just a simple Mach transition, then everything you do should have roughly the same conductivity at saturation with a semiconducting region below it. So yeah, O2, N2, H2, they all do the same thing. Water doesn't. We can talk about water in a minute, but water isn't a metal yet. This is the sapphire anvil that we use to reverberate the shock wave. It's an insulator. Why do we stop here? Because this guy is becoming conductive. And we need to find anvils which remain insulated to higher pressure. Okay, something about Uranus and Neptune. This is conductivity as we did a long time ago. This is water. This is ammonia. This is methane. This is something I call a synthetic Uranus. You mix water, ammonia, isopropyl all together. You get the ratio of elements they showed us on Monday, 7-4-1 for oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and it's hydrogen rich. What this says is that the conductivity is embedded here as a vent, because it's essentially made out of water, so when we study water, it's a lot simpler. Initially, anyway. Okay, PV curves up to 2 megabars. Temperatures on the Hugonia, we did this with Tom Aarons at Caltech many years ago. We know what the temperature is on the Hugonia.
Which will determine these temperatures?
Radiated. You have a shockwave traveling through the water, it's emitting light, and you put it on spectrum.
Okay.
Resolve it.
Did they have published some temperatures?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is all, the reference is on the thing.
That's a decade or more.
No, 20 years ago. Mitchell and I did connectivity a long time ago, and Neil did
it. That's even more ancient.
Yeah, this is ancient. I was telling you that we know a lot about the principal systems.
Oh, yes.
And the range you just told us was important here today. Most people don't know this, that's why I'm showing.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so round line here, connectivity here, what this says is there's no, you see, chemists think this is what happens in ambient. We don't see any of this. There's none there. That means if it exists, the lifetime is too short to matter. So it's a proton conductor. That's 50 GPa, 500 kilomers. Whole lot of stuff. Geez, at low temperatures. 40 years ago, Altura said that hydrogen or water is going to start ionizing chemically around 12 GPa. So that's what Neil found in his round on, is the attraction of hydrogen bonded water. It's going away, what he said. And then if you look at the Grunheisen parameter, it goes up for water, and then when you go to higher pressures than 12 GPa, it drops. So something is absorbing energy besides going at the temperature. What is it? Oh, it's breaking a hydrogen bond.
Yeah, so to clarify, that bottom plot is based on measuring the temperature and finding that the temperature is much lower than what you
No, actually, this is PVE only. There's no temperature.
Oh, okay.
We just did single and double shot experiments. They had given volume. What's the difference? Yeah. Okay, so now Ricky, he measured the conductivity of water in our cell up to 1.8 megabars. Again, this is limited by the conductivity of the sapphire. Okay, this is the earlier work by the Australians. This is what Mitchell and I did in a graph I just showed you. This is what the Russians did recently, Kakashev and others. This is what Ricky did.
I'll make one remark.
Yeah.
The early shots were all single shot, and the Art Mitchell's 82 data was also single shot, whereas our data and the Russian data were all ring-up experiments. So there's a difference in temperature in those experiments.
Right. It's a good point, Ricky. So why would you expect this all to lie a smooth curve? The answer is you can calculate the conductivity here as being caused by one proton per molecule. So if you've already got one proton for every molecule, it doesn't matter very much if the density and temperature change. That's why we did this experiment. We expected that, unlike hydrogen, if we had a proton conductor and we were getting no more, the conductivity were going to go up a factor of 2 or 3 or something like that, which is what it did. So you change the sample, you change the result and you get what you expect.
So this rather gentle rise is just an increase in mobility because of temperature primarily? Or is pressure playing an intrinsic role?
I don't know. I think
it's not clear. I mean, like, you see the blue line there is the work of the Trieste group. It's Cavagioni's Scandola.
Yeah, right.
And
Scandola, by the way, will be here next week.
I think in their paper, they're talking about just an increase in the proton mobility account for the increase. I'm not so sure about that, but I think it's probably a combination of all those factors, probably the increase in temperature and the mobility.
Mm-hmm. So are these measurements all along the Hugonio?
No.
So they're the same as the hydrogen ones.
The lower data ones are on the Hugonio.
These were taken
from the
same way.
So much for sure.
Not as many. Answer, so
if anyone's interested, the paper on water is going to be coming out next week, and I have them. I can give photocopies of the.
Yeah, I'd like to get a copy of that.
Oh, yeah, JCP next week.
Yeah.
Okay, so based on everything we learned about water, how would we summarize it? Let's see. Holtzapfel did some nice experiments on statically pressurizing heated water up to 1200 C, I think, and 10 GPa. It's water. Above it, these are Ricky's conductivity, these are double shocks. This is the Hugonio. The Russians always do things bigger, so they had a point in the literature way up there, so you can just easily extrapolate this. Gavazzoni et al. Say that when you get about 300 GPa and 7,000 degrees, you should have a metallic liquid. In other words, but kind of conduction will dominate over proton. And so this is roughly what happens. The interesting thing I found here is that as long as H2O plus stays together, it doesn't have a very high conductivity, just the H2O proton. But once you start breaking the hydrogen bonds, what goes along with that is the ability for a proton to be localized and to conduct in a minimum conductivity sense. You know, scatter every molecule, but you calculate the value in the same way you do the hydrogen metal. You just assume classical protons. Okay, this is for Raymond. Just a couple words on methane and benzene. Doug Hamilton did a couple shots on conductivity, and these are his data. And so he did that before we knew anything about conduction in hydrogen. So I simply said, what if you make the simplest possible approximation you can, and you say that methane decomposes like that, which is what we said 20 years ago, was the original idea. Throw this away, because there isn't much of it, it's not going to be much above the percolation limit. And say all the conduction is due to hydrogen. And then calculate from the density. So, okay, so now we have the shock pressure, I also have the shock density, so you can look at what fraction of that density is through the diamond and which fraction is through the hydrogen. You get a molar density of hydrogen, you stick it in the scaling laws, and you get the curve. And what this says is that at very low pressure, say 25 GPa, there's two orders of magnitude difference here, so this is probably methane. But as you go up in pressure, these guys are coming close together. Now we're talking about a factor of 5 or something. The chemical equilibrium people at Livermore calculate the degree of methane, and they say that's what's happening. It's hard to quantify it, but it looks like methane is coming apart on the degree, but not at real low temperatures and not abruptly. And there isn't much of it. I mean, there isn't much diamond in methane. So why not try benzene? Benzene is a lot of carbon. this one was kind of fun to think about. You have a thermally activated region. You have a plateau. What is causing this? I just made a similar assumption, namely that benzene is going to decompose this way. This will be diamond. Now we have mostly carbon. At the densities hydrogen find themselves in this, they're basically an insulator if this has a finite resistivity, which it does. So then you can do the following. What's this activation energy? It's like 10 volts. Is there anything in the system that can have an activation energy of 10 volts? I don't think so. There's going to be a hydrocarbon, which we know comes apart. Neil's done light scattering experiments the Russians have. There's a big volume collapse of 120 kilobars, 12 GPa. So it's come apart. There isn't benzene anymore. So there can't be any benzene hydrocarbon. There could be some others, but let's just say he was right. It can't be hydrogen because it's 10 volts. If the density of hydrogen in this, it should be more like 6. That's too big a difference. So what's the diamond? No, it's not, because diamond has a gap of 5 volts. And because these things nucleate and grow in only 100 nanoseconds, it's going to be defect. So it's not going to be a perfect insulator. It's going to be defective, disordered. It's at 3,000 degrees, So it's going to have some resistance that probably isn't very, very, very much with density and temperature. So what's causing this? Well, to me, a way to explain this is, as you go up to Eugonio, you nucleate and grow nanoparticles, sort of defective nanoparticles, and eventually they start connecting to one another. So if you're running a current through it, the area through which current can flow is activated. And that's what is causing this. One way to test that idea is to say, what's the density of diamond in this thing? Well, it's about 60% of the total. So it's very porous, and it's 60 here, 50 there. So it's right where you expect connectivity to be getting large, and thus the path for conduction to be getting large. So that makes sense. What about this value? Art Mitchell measured the conductivity of graphite, pure graphite, shock compressed into the diamond phase, and he got a value of 20. This is 40. So everything hangs together, basically.
But this is an instance, isn't it, where you wouldn't expect a shockwave experiment to tell you what the equilibrium system would have. That is, if I took
that material and squeezed it statically, to the same temperature and pressure,
right,
probably would not get the same result.
Right.
You would expect more dissociation. You'd expect the reaction to go much further towards the completion and lower pressure than temperature.
That's right.
Right.
But you might also even separate out the diamond.
I'm sure it's separated here too.
There's no evidence that anything like diamond forms.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Yes, there is.
I did it. Yeah, I mean, you can see the beam scanning from the diamond particles form in real time. And it goes like one lambda four.
What do you mean? But at what stage in the process? At the time the conductivity is measured or during pressure release? Makes a big difference. I understand that you can get powder at the end of the experimental shot, but that's a different question.
Steady shot.
In the shot front.
In a shot.
All right.
I'm saying when I reach this uniform pressure behind the chakra, you can watch these things form
right.
in real time.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're really
now,
there.
Your point is well taken. There's a kinetic effect to the shock wave experiment.
I think you can probably have a large amount of just trained hydrocarbons. That seems to be coming out of the diamond angle.
You don't need to invoke anything other than diamond.
Marvin, if it were those or graphite, basically, we have a different wavelength dependence, and the scattering would be about 10 to 100 times greater. So you can throw it out. It just doesn't matter.
This is an area in which more work needs to be done, also comparing static and dynamic experiments. But you have like 30 seconds.
He's right. I mean, Dave is right. This is a case where the timing makes a difference. Okay, this is a cartoon I found, and one day I realized it actually made sense. Scientifically, this is a joke. I mean, Jupiter, this is Comet Shoemaker Levy. You know, who threw these dirty snowballs? This actually is important, though, I think, because when you look at the photos they had of this thing when it happened, everything mixes. I'm going to talk about mixing in a second. Everything mixes, but it doesn't mix spherically. It mixes this way, right? So you can have anisotropic compositions. That's a version too. Okay, Jupiter is really interesting. Turbulence, high magnetic field.
Right. So interesting. Only the Jones 2 seconds.
Okay, well, it's been shown many times. This is temperature versus pressure for the conductivity experiments we did. We're not comparing theory with experiment. We're just saying that when Marvin calculated temperature versus pressure from roughly the surface temperature of Jupiter, he got a curve like this. And this is where we did our conductivity measurements, from which we got our scaling relationships for conductivity and functional density and temperature. The same, we're the same regime, that's all.
Okay, so what about that TP curve being calculated? Well, first of all, it's very interesting, I think, because all the other ones show temperature rising quickly and then continuing to increase. This one doesn't. This one has a large heat capacity here due to the dissociation of the molecule. So the nature of the state is going to be different than people thought.
It decreases, in fact.
Huh?
It decreases.
It might, yes. We don't know exactly because of all the uncertainties, but it could, in fact, decrease. That's the point he knows what I'm going to say. This hydrogen is not important for the magnetic field in terms of creating it, in terms of the conductivity, but it might have an immense effect on the stability of convection, which causes it. In other words, this has to be positive, as I understand it, right, for convection.
Yep.
So if helium will be hotter. These are poor thermal conductivity systems. If you add helium, this will be, so it might be very important in this system. And also, since the field is anisotropic, it might be that a few percent difference in the helium concentration around something as big as Jupiter could cause an anisotropy of the field.
One more word about real metallic hydrogen.
Okay, I learned how to do this from Dave here. I learned a lot of things from Dave. This is thermally activated conduction, like you did, many years ago. Sigma mod is 300. You take a density-dependent gap, and what's density and temperature on the isentrope? Okay, so what happens is all the published isentropes, or excuse me, band gaps. This is Niels that he did several years ago. This is Northwestern group. They're all LDA, and they all 23 years ago. Well, I'm glad you said that. You have a gap closing, right? when KT gets to be equal to the gap, you can no longer calculate anything. You know, KT is much bigger than the gap. There's no gap. It doesn't make any sense. So you have to stop when that happens. Okay. Now this one, I showed you the P rho T curve that Martin calculated. We scaled this, the prefactor sigma naught to the density dependence. And I just put those values into Marvin's isentrope, and I could calculate the connectivity all along this whole thing until I got to within a millimeter of this thing. So instead of being very discontinuous, we had a continuous curve. Then I just drew it the extra millimeter, not a cigarette commercial. This is the minimum connectivity of metal, 2000. In other words, it's a disordered system. It doesn't depend much on density temperature. So this is the connectivity in Jupiter and Saturn, actually, just that the scale changes. So out here, it's H2, it starts to dissociate according to Marvin, and then it's metal, and eventually it goes to complete dissociation at some point.
Very good.
Okay,
that's
all.
That's it?
Yeah.
Good. We'll take some questions, and they're only eating into Neil's talk.
Can you put back your last view graph?
Oh, sure.
The pressure at the top of the solid core in Jupiter is about 40, 50, 60 megabar, maybe. And it's definitely an OCP. So eventually, at something like of the order of 50 megabar, you must reach what you call the Stevenson limit, which is the OCP limit.
No, okay, that's an important point.
So bottom line, from your plateau, you, at some point you have to go up again.
That's quite possible, I agree with that. I'm just saying that as long as it's condensed matter, certainly, and not a plasma, I can't see how it's going to be a plasma, actually, because the Fermi energy is going to get so high in your system. The conduction is going to be dominated by the mean free path. And that's not going to change. I mean, I'm willing to say that as the number of carriers goes up, for example, you get more pressure ionization in these H2s and so forth, the conductivity will change a factor of 2 or 3 or something.
But
only way I know how to get a real long path is to form a solid.
Mm. My point is that doing very back of the end calculations, I might be wrong a lot. Neil knows this stuff much better than I do. But my point is that if you take the if a substantial contribution to the conductivity arises from stuff like H2 plus, for example.
It doesn't. Sigma is n e squared tall over m. M for h is 2,000 times bigger than that at e. Also, you wouldn't see it. As I learned from David here, these fields are basically dipolar. You can think of them as such. They go 1 over r. So you won't see the inside of a planet. You'll see the outside. And this says that rather than a planet, rather than Jupiter, okay, there's a couple of things. I didn't show a slide. This assumes a Coriolis boundary. I just went to Dave's paper that we calculated using its scaling relationships. And I said, what's rho and t at the Coriolis boundary of 3 megabars? And you get the number I got. That's where this came from. But what this says is that you reach the maximum connectivity in the surface region much farther out than the planet, which means 1 over r squared isn't going to attenuate the magnetic field very much, which means the surface field is going to be very large, which it is in Jupiter. It's not in Saturn, which is the same material for our purposes.
Phil, yeah, you're certainly right about the magnetic field aspect. The measurements that you've made, the state that you have, whatever one calls it, is the one that's important for the dipole. And it sort of works, as Raymond mentioned on Monday night. And I've also looked at this in much more detail. It works, so it makes sense. But it is still of interest to also know what happens at high pressure.
Yeah, I agree.
And that brings me to the question. I mean, I understand it's very hard to get to much higher pressures, but I wonder whether through experiment and through theory, one could start to get a sense of what happens at higher pressure. Is there any hope of that? I mean, what's the expected trend?
No, one of the things
4 megabars, 5 megabars.
Okay, yeah, that's more of it. Well, one of the things I would sort of confuse here is actually the word metal is, I see it along that red, that upper curve really should be a mixture, metallic-like mixture of H2 and stuff. It's not, but in any case, I think the answer to your question with experiments might come is really from the ICF people. In other words, what they do is they shock to the maximum compression of the single shock gangonium, in other words, starts to turn around. and then they go isentropic from there. And so they will get into the region, and they should, matter of fact, the data may already be available if somebody wants to try. So they which is at about, say, 1.5 megabar is the maximum compression of the nova you're going from the single shock. And they go isentropic from there, and they go into the highly degenerate region.
They go to 1,000 times liquid density.
Yeah, so they go to very high densities, and so that data.
Their
experiment can access that region. How you get measurements out that you need is something else again. There may be enough in the way of simulations already, because they simulate the hell out of it, that there's enough. You can extract out the kind of information you'd like to see, and it may be available.
But NOVA is closed now, isn't it?
NOVA is closed.
Well, there's enough data on target design that they you can play with.
But the answer to the question about this experiment, which is a physics experiment, we can get to 4 megabars now. The problem is not the pressure. The problem is the electrical insulation of the anvil, being able to measure something. But we're working on that. Right. We want to go to the highest possible pressure. Also, somebody said something about looking at surface ripples. Shoemaker-Levy. This says that there's no coronal boundary.
Yeah.
So, I mean, given the fact that they had a difficulty with resolution, I don't think they would have seen any ripple.
No, that's it. I think that's another issue. I think Dave made the comment that there was hope to see some excitation of modes. Shoemaker-Levy, and there was a wave phenomenon seen, but it had a totally different
effect.
Yeah,
that's
it.
Still about very well.
Okay. I have a question about deuterium and hydrogen. You mentioned that it's often used that hydrogen and deuterium should have the same properties.
Yeah.
But you saw the plot from Judah Gali with the, and that depended on the vibration frequency. The lifetime of dimers is approximately the same as the vibration frequency of the molecule. Mm-hmm. So that will change between E2 and H2. Yeah. So how can that affect the equation of state?
I don't think it affects it. It just defines that curve. Yeah.
But the fact, I mean, I thought the conclusion from that was that the molecule survives a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So the earlier comment you were making about how there are higher excited vibrational modes seems, maybe I misunderstood it. That's sort of a red herring in that
region. I think so. Yeah, that was a pure static back in the about what's liable to be the case here. Then you look at a more complex calculation.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Okay. Well, I'm